So again, thank you for coming. My name is Jeff Stokes. I'm a senior premier field engineer with Microsoft. This is the session on sustained infrastructure design. Basically, how do we build and operate a organization and infrastructure that is really supportable and running by best practices rather than, well, you'll see. So a little bit about me. I've been in IT for 17 years. I got my start at DEC. I don't know if anyone here has been from DEC or actually knows what DEC is anymore, but it was a fun time. I've been at Microsoft for 4.5 years. I started off as an escalation engineer for Exchange and then came over to Platforms PFE, where I've been for 3 years. In that time, I've spent 4 weeks a month for the last 3 years going on customer sites and helping them fix things, deploy things, or sometimes break things, but not very often. That's my email address. I also blog, Dude, Where's My PFE? So field engineering, for those who don't know, is basically a services arm of Microsoft where you can get someone that's an industry expert. They've been in the field for a long time. They have excellent training. They come on site and they can help you validate your plan, troubleshoot performance issues, troubleshoot design problems, handle critical situations where you have outages, things like that. So that's basically something that Microsoft has as an offering. I specialize in deployment and performance. So basically, I use MDT, Microsoft Deployment Toolkit, to create images for customers. And then I help them deploy them, sort of design that whole architecture out. And then also I critique builds, help people build better images of Windows. And for those who build images, you probably understand this pretty well. A lot of times it's the environment or ancillary things that make an image bad. Right, I do a lot of image reviews where the image is perfectly fine. The environment the image finds itself in is a totally different story. Those are my kids. Just thought I'd share. I have a couple dogs, and this is my wife's or my daughter's favorite animal. So PFE, Premier Field Engineer, we've talked about that. So sustainability and supportability, basically the whole idea of this is how do we build something that's repeatable? How do we build something that's supportable and also that when we bring someone in new, we transfer duties, they can actually pick it up, right? So we're going to talk about the objectives of the course. We've got the proactive considerations, and then we've got reactive, and then we've got some other things that sort of don't fit into those buckets. And one of the things that I would say is probably the most important thing that people don't do is consider performance in their design phase. They're not proactive about the performance and scalability of their environment that they've constructed. A lot of times we come in to an environment where, you come into the environment and you roll out Exchange on it. There's 10,000 users on this database and it's never run JetStress. There's never been any testing for scalability. It was implemented by a consultant, they're gone, it's done, it's production. It's these types of things that we want to vet out in the building of an engine to make sure it's actually going to sustain the load, sustain growth. What happens if you merge? What happens if you acquire people? Do you have a plan in place as part of your design spec that you've built out a solution that you're going to be able to go in and add services and scalability without any real disruption to the architecture? Also the supportability of it, and really just design considerations. We'll talk about that in a moment. So for performance, I would submit to everybody here that performance is not really hard. It's a different way of thinking about infrastructure, but it's not something that is necessarily hard to do. It's kind of like calculus or something like that, where it's intimidating if you're not familiar with it. We have some tools that are actually designed by field engineers, PAL, being the one I'm speaking of, that you can go in and analyze the performance of a system during your user acceptance testing and validate that your system's actually going to perform properly. We also have the WPA, WPR, the XPerf toolkit from the Windows ADK. This is another tool set that we can use to validate things like, are our drivers good? Do we have good code running on our systems? Do we have latency that we're not aware of between the SAN and our infrastructure machines? And then NetSH and NetMon we'll talk about a little bit also. So this is a graph from the tool that I was speaking about, PAL. A lot of people in this room are probably using VMware, and some of you are probably using memory ballooning. But are you really watching it? This is taken from a production SQL server where they're complaining about the system running slow. Can anyone figure out why? It's pretty easy, right? We're looking at 20 gig of memory stolen from the operating system. It's been ballooned away, and we're pretending that the SQL server has 20 gig of RAM that it actually doesn't have. Two megabytes available to the SQL box. For a while, 158 to 628 for 5 hours. Yeah, your users are going to feel that pain. It's going to be bad. So part of the thing here is that we get pulled on site to troubleshoot these types of problems, where when you come in and look at it with a simple tool that's free and available, it's self-evident how where the issue lies. What we want you to be able to do is go in and design a solution going forward where you've considered these types of scenarios and they don't happen in the first place, where performance isn't the boogeyman. Does it make sense? And with that, we're going to have Clint Huffman come up. He's the one that wrote PAL. He's going to give us a little short demonstration of how it works, show us how PAL operates.
Yep. Thanks, Jeff. So, so the PAL tool has really been in a marketing, or not marketing, I'm talking about marketing. So I'm a premier field engineer just like Jeff, and Jeff actually is probably one of our best ever boot performance guys. So if you ever have a boot performance question, he's actually the guy everybody goes to, by the way. So he's a bit modest. He's actually really, 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 really good, so which is why he's here today talking about some of these patterns that he sees. So, well, anyway, performance really isn't that hard. It's really just a matter of seeing the patterns and doing something about those patterns. So it's really about pattern matching. When you talk about computer systems, you know, we kind of feel like almost like computer psychologists. You know, you think about, okay, well, why did you make that decision? Why did you go down that path in the first place due to all these different circumstances? Well, the computers relatively are predictable in these pattern matchings, and we decided that in order to, I always thought that there was like this person at Microsoft that they knew everything about performance, and they just sat there in the room all day, and that's all they did was help people with performance issues. And I was waiting for this person to just go out and write a book and or write a tool that would just do all that performance analysis and make everything great and nice. What I found is that person doesn't exist, and that person will probably never exist because there's so much to the different pattern matchings that we get exposed to that we don't have a central place to put it all together. So I went on a project, and I created this as an open source project, and I decided I want to make it free, open source, and everybody can use it. Now, the reason I decided to do that versus working with System Center is because System Center is a great product. It's our flagship tool to actually go out and analyze and bring all that stuff together and put it together for you. But the problem is that when we go on site with customers, they don't always have System Center with them. And so I'm kind of left with gathering performance counter logs, and now I'm in a hotel room, got 10 performance counter logs, and I'm like, this is going to take a lot of work. So once you actually understand Windows architecture and Windows performance, you kind of think of how much work's involved in identifying those patterns. So now I was also teaching PowerShell and VB scripting. So I thought, what the heck? Let's put the two together. Let's actually automate this with a PowerShell script that will then give us those patterns and produce charts and graphs and give us gradients and the red stuff. Okay? So it's kind of fun. A lot of people approach me, they're like, you know what? Before the PAL tool, I had to try to explain and justify why a counter is bad. But now that you have red gradients in the charts, I can just show a manager and then know to fix that because it's red. So it's something about the red color actually ended up doing a lot. Now, this issue that we're seeing right here was actually, it was a SQL server that's loaded in VMware. And the story behind this is that this was one of a few SQL servers. And shortly after this, this box actually ended up blue screening and going down. The root cause here is that they decided to lock most of the RAM using pages locked in memory as a bit in SQL Server and locking up about 75% of the RAM. That's a common practice that we see out in the field with VBAs. And that's really kind of an asking yourself, do I want the operating system to control that RAM or do I want SQL Server to control that RAM? There's actually a very arguments on both sides on whether which one is right, and there really is not a good practice either way. It's really just try it out and see what you think. In this case, they went ahead and locked about 16 gigabytes of the RAM using SQL Server, and then VMware decided, you know what? It really isn't touching that RAM, so let's go ahead and balloon it out. So it was actually kind of useless to set pages locked to memory in the first place. on SQL Server. Now, I'm not a SQL Server expert by any means, but I did take a look at this, identify it, and even looked at the crash dump, and we saw that all the ballooning was being done by the all memory API, which is address with extensions. It is 64-bit as well. So what I want to show you is, instead of just talking about it, I want to actually show you the tool.
Uh-oh. Oh, there it goes.
So we go up to the website here. Oh, bring it across here. Is it left or right? There we go.
To the right. Sorry.
There we go. Okay. So where you go is to go to pal.coplex.com. And it's out there. Now, this was originally written by me as far as the framework of it, but there's actually a lot of subject matter experts, people who are in the field who specialize in each of these different technologies, and they contributed to the tool and added thresholds for it. So you don't have to worry about the patterns. We create the patterns for you. You just have to run the tool and work with it. The other thing is, I didn't want this thing to have to be a place where we had to have connectivity to the server. We had to have all this other stuff. So you can actually run this on a workstation by yourself with no connectivity whatsoever. You just run the BLG, the counter log, or CSV through the tool and analyze it, and it'll run through and generate these reports. Excuse me. Let me go ahead and bring up the tool here. So after you install the tool, the wizard is really easy. Just run the wizard. Actually, you can email me directly if you have questions about it. It is free and open source, and we're always working on it. Matter of fact, the best part about being open source is that, I think it's Horatio, he actually, this guy, he's just a fan of the tool, decided he wanted to go ahead and multi-thread this for me. And he just sent me the code. I reviewed it, worked out, and it was really nice and community-driven. So anyway, you point it to a BLG file, any performance counter log you get, run it through, and as you can see here, let me do the control one here, most of the Microsoft products are represented here, and all you have to do is pick one of the products that you're associated with, and then you're going to see something like Exchange Server, for example, Exchange Server 2010. So I didn't write this. A guy named Mike Lagasse wrote this. How many people heard of Mike Lagasse? Couple of you? Okay. So he's written a lot of documentation about Exchange Server performance. He's one of the leading folks on that. So he actually wrote these thresholds, not I, because I can't be a subject matter expert in everything. So that's kind of the mantra we go with in PFE, is that nobody knows everything, but together we can solve anything. So networking and helping each other out is key with that. So once you select a threshold file, you just run it through, hit next, and you can just next through this if you wanted to, but if you can provide a little bit more information about the number of processors, if it's 3GB switch, answer these questions just like you would talk to a doctor about how you feel, what's going on with your life, but answer some questions about the server, run through it just as much as you can, and when you finally get to the output, it ends up being a PowerShell script here that eventually gets executed. And once it executes, it applies all those thresholds and produces a report. So it's actually really, really easy to use. Okay. Oops. Okay. All right, maybe we got that PowerPoint here. There we go. Okay, so just to give it credibility, this is not some willy-nilly tool anymore. This actually started off as a hobby of a tool that I just wrote there in my free time, and it's actually expanded out and become a very, very popular tool. Almost everybody in Microsoft support now uses it because it applies those thresholds with reds, greens, and yellows and tells you where to start. Now, with performance counter logs, you're not going to find root cause. You're going to find symptoms. You're going to find what potentially led up to that problem. And then Jeff and I are actually working on a very interesting project called with Microsoft TechNet Wiki. We're calling it the Premier Field Guide to Windows Performance Analysis. So when PAL analyzes and finds a particular problem, it'll actually go through and have you go through some more steps of collecting more information and basically how we would ask a customer to troubleshoot these patterns and go through them. And then eventually, you might get down to XPerf. And knowing what things to collect in XPerf can be kind of challenging sometimes. But once you get XPerf going, XPerf can give you root cause in most cases. And if XPerf can't do it, heck, we'll start firing up the debuggers and showing you how to do that too. Now, if all that sounds overwhelming to you, you always got us. You can always call us at Premier Field Engineering, Microsoft Services, Microsoft Consulting Services. You can call us up. We can give you help on these issues and work with it. So I didn't want to go through and talk about it, but we've had a 306,000 downloads of this tool over the lifetime of it the past few years. And as you can see, there's a lot of books being written about it, or at least mentioning the tool quite a bit, magazine articles, people out in the field who are even speaking about it at SQL Pass and other things like that because of the patterns that it does. So I'm going to leave with that. Paladocoplex.com is where that tool is at, and I hope to get a lot more patterns and documentation and prescriptive guidance in the tool. That's the power report I just generated, by the way. And I hope this will help you work. I'll actually show you a little bit here. Can I? Yeah, there we go. Yeah. So actually, you want to show this one?
Oh, go ahead.
You know a little bit better?
Oh, that's, oh yeah, that's true. Okay.
So anyway, hope you like the tool.
Thanks, Clint. So essentially, on this particular blog or BLG that we're looking at for this is the sample BLG that you did.
Oh, is it? Okay, yeah. Sorry. And not the SQL.
We've got one here that's actually a SQL server where I have a customer. I have a lot of customers, so I can sort of say I have a customer and be vague about them. Where they're actually going through and vetting out their production system beforehand. They've designed it, they've architected it the way they think it needs to be done, and they're going through with LoadRunner or something like that and generating transactions through their web interface to pound on the SQL box on the back end and validate, will this thing actually withstand the amount of load that we plan on sending to it? And when I first talked to them at the very beginning, before we did any sort of discussion about the performance aspects or anything like that, they told me what they're going to do, and I said, you're going to have two problems. Your web front end is going to be high on CPU, and your disks are going to be too slow in SQL. And it's as simple as just talking through the architecture of what they planned on doing. It was totally something you can see coming. It's like, you know, sort of like a train wreck, right? Or, you know, a car wreck where it's like, you know, I really don't want to see this, but it's going to happen, you know? So we talked them into doing some testing. Let me get to the disk on this guy. We have some disk issues. Now, for the most part, they're spiky. So you know, if you're running a production system, you can expect some spikes, right? There's going to be some random behavior where things just sort of spike up. But you can see in some spots, we're actually hitting averages, 25, 27 milliseconds on average to do our disk traffic is too much. Too much for SQL. And if you wanted to know why, we've got it right here where we're pointing out how to rule out your disk bound problems. So in the report that I generate and give to my customer, I can actually say, here's where you're breaching. I'm not going to give them the whole thing because it's overwhelming, right? So maybe I'll strip out some of the screenshots, but I've got all the links and articles and everything right here that if they want more information to validate what I've told them, it's there on TechNet or a blog or a storage white paper.
If I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
So one of the things about the thresholds that we use, it isn't a golden rule that 25 milliseconds or more is a problem. What we do is we base that off of 64K-sized IOs, and normally that's a pretty easy size for disk to run through and get. So if it's 64K or smaller, and you're seeing IO times that are taking greater than 25 milliseconds, the reason why we consider that too slow is because a standard 7200 RPM disk drive should be able, at worst case, full stroke, getting the data at the hub, the very inner hub of the disk, the worst place it could possibly get it. It should, the manufacturer guarantees that you can usually get that IO within 13 milliseconds or less. And that's the worst case scenario. So if we're doing 25 milliseconds on average for minutes at a time, that is twice what it should be taking that disk to respond with. And you can actually cross-reference this with the size of the I.O., which is another pattern that's in there, cross-reference that to actually see, was this I.O. 64K or smaller during that time? If this was 2 megabyte-sized I.O.s, you know, that might have been just fine. But if it's like 64K or smaller, it would have been, a problem.
Right, absolutely. Yep.
We even have a joke in there, actually. I put a joke in there one time that, how many people understand the average response time of a floppy disk drive? Anybody know that answer by chance? Remember how fast it was when you put that floppy disk drive in? Okay. As a joke, and I left it in there by accident, I put in there that 600 milliseconds on average is the average I/O speed of a floppy disk drive. So I put that in there as a rule for the heck of it. And you know what's happening is we constantly see that coming up. Many people think of these SANs as the overwhelming flow of IOPS. It always has IOPS. It always has performance. It always has this stuff. But in reality, just like any overflowing resource like that, and these things are great resources, great devices, but anything can actually get overwhelmed. So that's why we're seeing these kind of responses. So,
absolutely.
Sorry, go ahead.
No problem. He brings up a good point about the SAN. This is actually SAN-attached storage. So when we see the SAN performing slower than we would expect an actual fixed disk, to perform, and then we can actually go in and look and see how many IOs, things like that. We've seen where the SAN, we're trying to push 20 or 30 IO to it, 4K writes, and we have latency in the seconds. Not milliseconds, but seconds. So these types of patterns will show up very clear in this tool, and it's like, this is just right out. 20 milliseconds versus a second or two or 30 seconds, clearly we have some problems somewhere.
At least it's worth investigating.
It is certainly worth investigating, absolutely.
And you can show your manager, look, it's red. It's a problem.
Right. When I was in CTS as an exchange engineer, one of the things that I did is I specialized in performance problems for back-end exchange systems. And I would go through and run it through PAL. As I'm going through the PAL engine, parsing through my BLG file, I'm going through it manually, and PAL's basically my backup. It's my buddy. It's to point out things that I may have missed. And then it's also there so that when I find the things, and then I can find it in the PAL report, I've got the exact documentation I need to go and send that to the customer. Then, it looks like you spent hours and hours and hours on it. Maybe it took an hour or two. Yep.
Yep.
And there's real value in it, plus it's free. So this is one of the tools that we would encourage you to kind of take a first step for when you're planning your infrastructure, when you're looking at triaging performance problems. But really, like these guys, they're vetting out their system. Is it going to work with the load that we expect it to have? And the answer is no, it's not.
Yeah, we got a question? Go
ahead. Yeah.
Overhead to running this? Oh, yeah. We just found it just a few weeks ago, we actually got a multi-thread in now. And I can tell you, if you create four threads and you have four processors on your machine, it will max out all four processors. It is quite a lot of overhead. So this is why you don't run this thing on a server.
Right.
You run this on a workstation or something that you don't care so much about. Just let it crank through it and get its job done. It is designed to be decoupled from the environment, so that way you can just run it straight up on your workstation. So it's a great question. Another thing, too, how many people read the description of performance in mass for this session? Okay, so one of the things that you can do as far as performance in mass is export the threshold file export a template from PAL into a performance monitor template. And you can use a command line tool called logman.exe to now push that template out to a whole bunch of your other machines, and then gather that information, which will be everything that PAL analyzes for that particular threshold file, and it'll analyze that and bring it back into the report for you. Yeah, so he's got it right there. And we support back to Windows XP format. We support back for Windows 2008, Windows 7, and we'll be upgrading the tool pretty soon for Windows Server 2012 and maybe even rewriting the user interface to be a kind of a Windows 8 application design. So.
Right, but to be clear, yes, it generates a lot of load, but only when it's processing. To actually collect the perfmon BLGs, if you don't know what you're collecting, if you just collect everything in perfmon, that's going to generate a lot of load on your system. But if you use these templates where, like the example I have here is Active Directory, right? So if we go in here,
I'm going to export it to text.
Right, we can export it right there, and you see the people who helped create it. Kip, Matt Reynolds, and Clint. So those guys, you're not Active Directory, but Clint,
I'm not.
Yeah, Clint's not Active Directory.
I act like one on TV, though.
Yeah. Kip and Matt Reynolds are basically as sharp as it comes in Active Directory for field engineering. So the problems they see real world get translated into that template. Yeah. So when you export that out, you're only monitoring for the counters of interest. So then the impact on the system you're monitoring is 1-2% maybe. It's very light. Yeah. Does it make sense? Yeah. And you had a question?
Oh, yeah? Okay, so the question is every time he runs the tool, that context switching gets flagged often. I've been playing around with that threshold and trying to figure out what's a good value for it. Really, context switching is, for those who don't know, is where a thread will change, where a processor changes from one thread to another. That's a context switch. And so if we constantly have too many of those, it's like, you know, doing email, you know, doing IM, you got somebody calling you up on the phone. You have all these things trying to grab your attention so much so often that you don't get any real work done. So what you have to do is correlate the context switches per second with private memory or privilege time on the processor, which is the kernel time. So basically, if you're not seeing a whole lot of kernel time on the processor, then context switching is really a wash. It's not really a big deal. I do plan on updating that so that I actually take both into consideration before flagging it. But right now, it's more of a warning level that I flag it at. I had a case not too long ago. I call it the case of the 2 million context switches per second. That was a new world record that I had ever seen. And that was all disk I/O. And what happens is when we actually go down to disk, when a thread needs to have disk access, the processor will realize, hey, that's a slow resource. So I'll park that thread and have it set on the side while I work on other threads. And we were doing so much quick disk access all the time that we end up getting a lot of context switches because of that. So point being is what I'm trying to tell you is that that PAL will flag things. It doesn't necessarily mean it really is a problem. It just says it warrants investigation. I always say that this tool is not a replacement for performance analysis, but it is a time-saving tool to kind of put you in the right direction.
It's a buddy. It's a tool.
I can talk to you afterwards if you want to talk more about context switching. So
here are the CPU usage of the machine. Now, do you notice something interesting here? If we come down, it's got two cores, but it's a VM. So can we trust these? Can we trust processor in a VM? No, we cannot. Does it probably have a problem? It could. But like he said, we need to go and investigate it further. We don't go and beat them up and say, hey, your CPU's too busy, but it's something we need to investigate. Fortunately, VMware, if you install the VMware editions, gives you VM processor and VM memory, so we can actually go in and judge those. In Hyper-V, we just judge it all from the host. And we look at the guests individually and see what their CPU is doing. But in VMware, we can actually insert that template where we're judging the CPU and disk activity that we're getting reported back from the hypervisor, which is where we got this at. If we go back up, that's our VMware template.
And we're actually considering adding thresholds for these, but we're actually looking for a representative from VMware to help us with these thresholds. So if you know somebody, please point them our way. We've been looking for that.
We've been looking for a while. They don't want to talk to us. I even called their 1-800 number. He told me to open a case.
It's a free and open source tool. It's a free and open source tool, and we actually have Citrix partnered with us on this tool as well. So they've actually got a Xen app threshold file. And so we're completely open with this, and we're willing to work with other vendors. So if you have performance counters, I'm willing to add them to the thresholds and add them to the tool.
The other thing that's interesting is that I used to work, before coming here to Microsoft, I worked at a financial firm where we had Microsoft Consulting Services come in and help us write a derivatives application that ran on Itanium. And all it did was sit there and grind all day long on all the cores and figure out derivatives for the stock investors, the traders. And so what they did is MCS showed them how to actually write our own perf counters, and then we made a template and used that for data collection and for analysis. So we can go in and see exactly what's happening in our particular application. Same thing for System Center Operations Manager. If you make your own custom counters, you can then import those and create rules off them, things like that. How many people have an in-house app? Everybody? Right? Just about? How many of those people have actually written a perfmon counter that tells you whether it's broken or not? Oh, you have one. Yeah? It's rare though, right? Yeah.
And I know this conference, we talk a lot about Windows Azure and the cloud and such, and we actually do have a PFE who wrote a data collector in what is Azure to collect counters just so we could run it through PAL.
So. Yep, it's pretty interesting. Yep. Here's the performance guide that Clint was mentioning. And this isn't all about performance, I assure you, but I hope we're not beating you guys up with all this stuff. But the PFE performance guide is basically this this book that we're trying to get off the ground that anyone can access for field performance. So if you don't understand something, eventually PAL's going to point back to this guide.
Yes.
And we'll provide guidance on, well, if your disk IO is this and you have this many IOPS, but they're this size, then maybe you don't have a problem. Maybe like a choose your own adventure almost, if anyone remembers those.
Yeah. But, as a matter of fact, next year at TechEd, Jeff and I are going to try to do a path to performance for Windows Server 2012, where we'll basically show you how to troubleshoot just about any performance problem using PAL to analyze counters first. Once you get a pattern that matches that, then it'll take you down that rabbit hole, or adventure, as you want to call it, down to how to troubleshoot that issue. It may be going down to XPerf, down to debugging, whatever it takes. We're going to try to make that happen next year.
Yep, absolutely. So we were talking a little bit about XPerf. This is basically a tool that's built into the, or comes with the Windows ADK, the Windows, I forget the name of it, Assessment and Development Kit? No, Deployment Kit. Assessment and Deployment Kit. I should remember that. And the Windows Performance Toolkit comes with these tools, XPerf, XPerf View, Windows Problem Recorder, Windows Problem Analyzer, where you can go in and actually specify the type of problem you're having, like this. And you can pick what resources you want it to tail, record that log of what's happening on the system, and then you can go back and go over that and analyze it with public symbols and find out where your culprit is. And this slide right here is actually from a system where the customer was bleeding edge on technology, 10 gigabit Ethernet NICs. Their system could get to about 2.5, and then it just wouldn't go any faster. They started getting network queues. So when you pay for 10 gigabit Ethernet, you expect to get somewhere close. Somewhere. 2.5 is probably not it. So what we found when we went in is we started looking at the driver generating all these deferred procedure calls. It was only using 4 cores out of 16 on the box. They had a driver limitation, so when they actually opened up a case with the manufacturer of that particular card, said, oh yeah, we're still working on that driver. It's not really ready yet. So you bought the 10 gigabit Ethernet, and someday you can have that bandwidth. Someday.
And as far as DPCs, for those that aren't familiar with DPCs, think of them as hardware interrupts, but they're low-priority hardware interrupts. So too much of these things could actually spell either hardware or driver issues. That's what that pattern tells us.
Exactly. You can see right here where we're looking at it in terms of the DPCs, the interrupt DPC from NDIS. So NDIS is essentially sitting there on those 4 cores. The rest of them, not very active at all. A lot of times, you end up playing the vendor fight. Am I right? I mean, you're customers. Yeah. So you bought this solution, and maybe you had this contractor that developed it, and then it runs this third-party software, and then it has the Microsoft operating system, and when it breaks, where are you? You're in the middle. Yeah. Right? I mean, half the time when I was in the support queues, I was on a conference bridge with 15 people, and we're all arguing over whose fault it is, which isn't very productive. But when you get to this level of diagnostics, with this trace, we're able to show them exactly where their driver was. We couldn't see the function calls their driver was making because we don't have their source code, but we could clear as day nail it and say, this is where it's faulting at. And at that point, it's, okay, we see what you're talking about, we'll get back to you. You know, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, there's a new version of the driver out.
Yep. Having the evidence is proof.
Having the evidence is proof.
Yep.
I'm a bit of a cynic. Has anyone ever... Well, no, maybe I shouldn't say that. I used to think that some of our OEMs and third parties would open a case with our support even though they knew it was their fault so they could get us to debug it far enough to show them where the problem was. And I think they still do. But maybe you've seen that, I don't know. Maybe I'm a cynic. So if you wanted to learn more about how performance actually works, and you're involved with Premier, we have an offering called Vital Signs, where we'll come in and teach you. A field engineer will come in and teach you. You can go to an open class that's an enrollment base, come in and learn more and basically understand. It's not going to make you, you know, Mark Rusinovich. It's not going to make you an expert, but it's going to give you that ability to go in and troubleshoot to an extent that you'll be able to speak intelligently when you have to go back and talk to the SAN team or the network team. You'll be able to say, well, we're seeing this and this and this, as opposed to saying, well, we think it's the network.
Yeah, this is actually more of a, this class is more of a Windows internals, more of a Windows architecture type of discussion with the workshop. And so in order to know the counters and what you're measuring, you first have to know how the thing works before they get a better idea of how what's going on. And there are certain counters that are kind of debatable simply because we can only measure so much in the operating system without slowing it down too much. I think there's a cat-in-the-box thing that one physicist had, where if you monitor too much, that you actually slow it or change the effects of it. So the operating system folks are very particular about what they measure in the operating system. As we actually tell you about, okay, when you look at this counter, it might be, there might be circumstantial evidence that this was the problem, a guess as what it might be, but not necessarily completely scientific in the understanding of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we show you the performance counters, and then how to move on from there.
We also have an advanced that teaches you the deep level of XPerf type of tracing, where you can get really deep into it.
Yeah.
And then we have a debugging class too, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, those are many levels deep there. I've taken it six times, the user mode debugging class, and I still feel that I'm humbled by what I see. So those guys are just amazing when they can see, they can see the code and say, oh yeah, there's the problem. And I'm like, that's ones and zeros, dude. That they can do that. They're pretty good at it. But you guys can do it too. It's just a matter of learning those patterns and learning the
tools.
Bless
you. So. Yep, absolutely. So let's talk about support for a little bit. When we build a solution to a business problem, are we building it in a supportable way? A lot of times when I've been requested to get involved on behalf of the IT department of a particular customer, when I arrive on site, it's the business has this problem. They want to address it this way. You don't have a KB that says that's the wrong way to do it, but we think it's the wrong way. Can you help us out? Anyone ever been in that boat? The business absolutely wants to do something that when you look at it from an IT perspective, it's like, oh my God, you know? So Aaron Margosis, anyone know him? Maybe heard his name before? We have a joke we're going to make, a KB that says if a Microsoft field engineer tells you don't do this, then that's good enough. So we just have the blanket KB article. I don't know if we're going to be able to get it up there or not, but we're working on it. But he actually wrote some articles that are pretty interesting. Sticking with well-known and proven solutions. And we have another one by a field engineer on the case for not being unique in IT. If you're doing something that you can't find any documentation for, no one's ever done before, and Microsoft says, no, don't do this, the OEM says, no, we've never seen that happen before, chances are, when it breaks, you're going to be in a bad boat, right? Maybe. But yeah, oftentimes we get called in just to address this particular type of scenario where, is there a KB for this? Is there a blog for this? Anyone still running XP? Sure, some people here are running XP. Yeah. Do you like solid-state drives? Do you wish your XP booted faster? This article...
It's flag day today.
This article is a result of a customer that insisted on getting SSDs for their management. They found that to be authoritative enough, and it's basically a walkthrough of everything you have to turn off. What are the little nitpicky things we need to do to make sure we don't just, drive the SSD into the ground? What do we have to disable and turn off to make this actually work and be a valuable solution? So a lot of the content you're going to find in blogs from field engineers are these kind of one-off situations where we're asked to come on site and come up with a unique solution to a business problem, and we found out a way to make it work and maybe even a way to monitor it in case it breaks.
And that's why we're working on that project with the PFE performance guide to bring all this together in the one location. That way you're not fishing and searching and looking for these one-off issues. You actually have some prescriptive guidance that actually gets you to that level.
Yep. So I'm going to go over a couple design things that I've seen in the field that are sort of repeatable, not mistakes, but opportunities, I guess. Things I've seen that when you kind of look at it in retrospect, you think maybe that's not something they should have done or that you would have thought to do. But at the time, it was either management by magazine, new management, someone came in, you have to do this, we're going to do this different, the old way's not any good, you get insourced, outsourced, you know, change, right? So I'm going to tell you a tale of an end user. We have a user, very happy user, uses their laptop, and they talk to a file share. It's pretty simple, right? You know, they do their work group stuff. They're in there typing away, making Word docs. They hope it's backed up because it's on the file server they're trusting. Maybe we're using SMB for our protocol. So maybe there's a little bit of troubleshooting. We have to keep that up to date. I recommend everyone keep their SMB up to date. This is one of the bits I look for in my patches when I implement a solution. Surely we're running antivirus. Has anyone ever had a server go down because they're running AV on it? Yeah. How many times have you caught a virus with that same server, right? I mean, really, how many? It's almost as if running antivirus becomes a risk in the environment greater than getting a virus in the first place. Sometimes. I know, I'm being a cynic.
We're not saying antivirus software is bad.
No, we're not.
We're just saying that, you know, well-behaved ones are good. So.
And by the way, if you install antivirus out of the box and just hope for the best, chances are you're not excluding the files that are important for Windows and various types of systems to run to where you don't, you know, quarantine the JET database log for an Exchange server and you know, bring an Exchange server down. And it's interesting, we actually had, when Windows 7 was in beta, a big argument internally, and I'm probably not supposed to talk about it that way, but it was fun. It was a fun one. No one thought they should have to own the antivirus exclusion list for everything. Well, why would Windows need to know what the exemptions are for SQL? They don't need to know. Why would SCCM care what the exclusions are for BizTalk? So we got together, me and a couple of field engineers got together, and we wrote a blog that has all the recommendations for antivirus for different products. And then in the spirit of keeping it all shareable, we put it on a wiki too. Out of the box, I would basically guarantee that no one's actually following all this. Slow logons, log files getting eaten, you name it. You know, we can see all that, all those types of problems because of antivirus. It is good to have antivirus and be secure, don't get me wrong. But, you know, just implement it in a solution that sort of makes more sense. Let's go back to here. So let's get back to our end user. Right? They're running SMB, antivirus, third-party firewall. Don't trust the Windows firewall. Want to run a different one? Don't disable the service, please. You break other things if you disable the firewall service. Hopefully everyone knows that. If not, you do now. Are you running Big Brother software? I did a Windows desktop wrap for a customer once where they actually had two departments that watched all the employees and then watched each other. You know what? They booted slow. And I mean, how do you go walk into that situation with a straight face? Okay, we're running this product, we're running this product, and they both come up at basically the same time, and they monitor each other because we don't want anyone to be able to do anything with any of the documents that's not appropriate, and we need to monitor the end user so we trust them, so we keep it all. Well, I mean, if that's their business requirement, what's the cost of doing business in that manner is really what needs to be conveyed to the business. Don't come back and beat up the vendors and the third parties. It's interesting in that that customer was also the one that was very proud of their server farm that they spent a bunch of money on and then beating up the OEM and buying 4,900 RPM hard drives instead of 7,200 RPM hard drives for the laptops. So they saved like 40 or 50 bucks per unit by taking all these features out of the laptops, and then they complained everything was slow across the enterprise. Okay.
Most of these stories kind of end with,
They do. So we change the end user experience. We go from having a file server where the user can actually store their data to something else. Why is my arrow coming up first? That is the most bizarre thing.
That little bouncy thing.
Yeah.
That's cute.
So we're going to virtualize our file servers. Has anyone done a file server consolidation? Those are pretty popular. It's not a bad idea to do. Yeah. File server consolidation? Absolutely. So we're going to take all the file servers for remote offices, and we're going to bundle them all up into a central repository. We're going to go from 17 file servers to 4, and then we're going to have other VMs running on that VM host. Everyone with me so far? All right, it's not too bad of a plan so far. So we got our end user here. The end user has to go across the LAN to access their files now. They're still on XP, so they can't use branch cache, so that's out. That virtual machine is using an iSCSI initiator and software in the VM on shared 10 gigabit Ethernet in the VM host on a Windows 2003 32-bit server, so we don't get the 64-bit better kernel for memory management and handling that big file cache and all that stuff. This is bad. This is an awful solution. Now, how could we have changed it, though? Maybe if we had to change the way we're doing the operating system. But it's the looking at it from that mile-high perspective. We're going to do this. Well, you have 9 points of failure. They're also writing back to a SAN, or a NAS I didn't mention, right? So the software iSCSI initiator is talking back to the NAS. So we have shared disk, shared network, shared VM, WAN, and then end user. And I said, I think we're going to have some performance problems, and when it breaks, we're not going to know where to troubleshoot it. And it was interesting, because I'm telling the director this, it was his plan, and one of the old guys there, you know, probably in his 50s or so, said, you know, because everyone else was afraid to talk to him. So he says, you know, when we consolidate our Citrix farm, we went from 23 servers to 34. Wow, I'm guilty of working in that kind of environment where I've consolidated up instead of down. Maybe you guys have too. It's an accident. You know, scope creep. Come on. VMs are free, right? Well, they used to be. Yeah. Now they cost a lot of money. You want to talk for a little bit, or should I go into my stories?
No, go ahead. No.
Okay. So some of the things that we've looked at in terms of operational issues is that we have, and I've lived through an environment just like this, where you have an environment that you're going in and you're doing monitoring, and the person that set up the monitoring doesn't work there anymore. And so that headcount got allocated to somebody else as a half-time job or a quarter-time job. Anyone getting 2,000 or 3,000 emails a day from their alerting system that get redirected to deleted items? Yeah, there's a lot of guilty people out there, isn't there? I did the same thing. I mean, literally 3,500, and patch. We didn't have the thing to do maintenance mode on our servers, so we actually did maintenance. It was about 8,000 emails. The worst part is we were journaling all those permanently. Well, you know, it's for audit, right? So you have to keep everything. So if we have that much spam in our monitoring solution and we're just basically ignoring everything that's flowing through our inbox, do we catch the fact that one of our domain controllers hasn't replicated in 3.5 years? Probably not. Active Directory is resilient, is it not? It is. He'll happily say, well, you know, I can't figure out who you are because I, you know, you weren't hired 3.5 years ago, so go talk to him. I don't know what you're about. And, you know, I my replication's messed up. And we've gone to environments with 18, 20 domain controllers where only one of them works, the central one. But isn't that a testament to the product? You have 18 DCs and only one of them works and you didn't notice until we did a risk assessment on it? That's awesome. I mean, that's exciting news. Is it not?
That's a good story.
I love that. It was still up. You know, it's great. It's good news.
Well, one of the reoccurring patterns that I think a lot of us have seen is that, you know, a quote Greg Hughes, and this is probably a quote from many other people, but most of the time there's not technology problems, there's mostly people problems. So, you know, one of the things I want to kind of leave you with is that, you know, if you have great management with great patterns and who trust their employees, I know how many people don't get trusted in their employees? You know, so it's like you have to worry about that, you know. But if people are, if there's some trustworthy computing going on and you trust your people and things are going on, usually the process of technology is pretty simple at that point. So I wish I could solve your management problems. But this isn't a management class, unfortunately. So, but it is a common problem that we see.
Aaron Morgosis was wearing a shirt or a pin or something yesterday that said, "Hi, computer, I'm here to fix your user problem." And it's that type of thing where is management killing the IT process? One of the things that used to drive me nuts when before I joined Microsoft is I would spend all this time researching the problem and going through KB articles and reading blogs and getting all this data together and building the perfect solution. You put it all together and then it's, well, what's Microsoft say? Well, but, so then, you know, you go and you contact Microsoft. Now that's a good place for you, instead of calling the phone queue, right, to actually access a field engineer who will take an advisory case and sit down and look over the plan and either rubber stamp it, make a blog out of it, write a book about it, or give you some advice on how to make it a little better. The phone queues aren't really, you know, made for those types of remote advisory cases, but over and over again, is there not a need for you to get someone else to say, you know what, we're getting ready to upgrade to the new version of AD. Is there any gotchas that we don't know about? Anyone ever dealt with Kerberos token bloat? Yeah, where your packet size is too large and won't fit in UDP anymore? If you had had an advisor look at that plan going forward, maybe you could have nipped that in the bud. And that's actually something I end up finding the hard way in my organization, was that particular problem.
And one thing about our organization that is interesting, too, is that many customers, when they were implementing Server 2008 R2, waited to implement it into production until we had a risk assessment program from our organization or a health check that we could go on site and actually check it over to make sure there wasn't anything that's off in left field on this thing and make sure that they're not going to fall, that's not going to fall in its face when things actually go into production. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, I was on a health check just 2 weeks ago, and they're ready to go into production. It's ready to go. Everything's ready. Everybody's going for that. I look over the configuration, and I'm like, you know, your encryption key is corrupted. You're not going to be able to talk to your database. As soon as you try to actually put some load, it might work for a little while because of the cache credentials on the servers, but as soon as you reboot or restart these services at some point, it's going to fall. So we had to restore their key and end up reconfiguring BizTalk again just to get that encryption key going again so the SSO services would work. Had we not found that with a health check, they probably would have been wondering what's going on and having some more problems with it.
It goes back to the whole thing of, do we want to be preventative or reactive? Are we ahead of the game or are we behind it? And sometimes that's a hard sell to management that, you know, how many people have time to go and read a blog in their workday? I can't count the amount of times I've gone on site to a customer.
I want your job.
Yeah. Go on site to a customer, they have a problem, it's like, well, you know, it's on this blog and there's a KB and here's the hot fix and everything. And they're like, God, how did you know that? It's like, well, you know, it came out 2 years ago. But if you don't have time to keep up with your industry, you're short-staffed. And that's, you know, if there's IT managers here, if your people aren't screwing around, you know, cruising TechNet and on Facebook a little bit, you're understaffed. If you're so busy that you're constantly fixing things instead of planning things, you're understaffed. The people thing is really getting bad. There's a statistic out there that 400,000 new IT jobs are created every year in the States, and we graduate about 200,000 IT professionals a year. It's good job security. That's about all I can really say in a positive light on that. So this is a story. We had a crit sit where they spent a lot of money designing and implementing a system. They wanted to have a load balancer, hardware load balancer, in front of their CAS array for Exchange, F5. Great. Set it up. They ran it through all their tests, handled all the load. Perfect. Perfect implementation. Set up the monitoring software on it, using it for about 3 or 4 months. A CAS server out of the array crashes, and no one can get into email in the entire company. 16 CAS boxes, 15 of them are up, and no one can get an email. No one was monitoring the system to say, well, yeah, it's up. That's good. And the thresholds are okay. That's good. But is there activity? Are we monitoring for presence? Does it actually work the way it was built to work? Is it load balancing? No. The F5 was never configured to move off the first CAS box. That was a crit sit instead of a risk assessment before production, where we have an XRAP where we actually go in and validate some things and make sure that we can hit it from multiple servers and all those stories, right? But you look at those types of problems, are they preventable? Yes. but only if you can convince management and get the budget to do the preventative versus the reactive. I've been to a lot of customers in the premier space where they have hours where they could use us, but instead of using us, they say, well, you're only for emergencies. No, we're not. We're like the military advisors. We're like the, you know, the Marine Corps of technology. We send one guy in and he shows you how to shoot the gun really well, and then we leave and you're awesome. It's not, you know, hey, you need to go to Puerto Rico tomorrow because it's on fire and, you know, Active Directory's messed up and this and that. Right? You see the difference, of course. But, yeah, if you have premier dollars, make sure you're using them in a proactive light to enhance your own skill sets and get ahead of the IT game instead of playing that reactive sort of runaround.
And one of the things we were thinking about talking about in this talk, which I'll just briefly mention, is that our PFE organization originally started off as RREs, Reactive Response Engineers. That's how we originally started. As you may have tell, crit sit all the time. Red flags, hit the red button, get somebody on site right now. Oh, you do have a thing on this.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, so we were very reactive, and now after a few years of doing our proactive services, our risk assessment programs, health checks, and workshops, we've now are much more proactive organization. And matter of fact, my schedule's filled up about five months out right now with proactive work because we're just in extremely high in demand right now and don't have enough people really to help out. Which I might add, we are hiring, by the way.
Absolutely, we are.
Because we can't keep up with the demand right now because there's a lot of work for us.
So another thing that we've noticed, and this became basically a case study, does everyone familiar with the adage that you don't virtualize all your domain controllers? Right? That was pretty common, you know, for a while. Don't virtualize all your DCs. Have a physical box. Does anyone here think there's a technical reason for that? Do you think if it's in a VM, it just won't work? You know what it is? Supportability. It's supportability. We don't treat a VM with the same sort of respect we treat a piece of hardware in the data center, it turns out. So what we had is a textbook case of why not to virtualize all the DCs and leave one of them as a physical box where you're getting a good, you know, system state backup and everything's good with your Active Directory. They had two domain controllers, small company, 1,500 users. And on this VMware host, they had both domain controllers on the same host. They didn't have battery backup in the cache or the RAID controller. They didn't have a UPS. They hadn't backed it up, and they lost power. So you come back up, JET database error, -1608 or something like that on one domain controller. Okay, well, that's broken. Let's go to the other one. Oh, hey, the event log says it hasn't replicated in 2 years. Huh, all right. So they FedEx us a copy of their JET database. And we get a guy from the Exchange development team to go through and debug the database and try and poke holes in the bind. I mean, really, he's going through with a hex editor trying to get rid of little corrupt blocks around the database to try and get it to actually come up. Failed. 1,500 users out of work for 3 weeks. And probably an admin out of a job. Yeah. We don't know that part. But if you look at it, is that preventable? Yeah, it's preventable. Have more than one host. Have a battery backup in the cache controller. Make sure Active Directory is actually replicating. Spread things around. But what's the practical guidance? Can we tell you all that in a KB article or a TechNet post? Can we say, hey, do this the way it really makes sense to? No. We'd insult people. So what do? Make one physical because you treat it like a physical box is really what the message is. And it's an unfortunate story. I mean, you think about it, 1,500 users, it's not a small company. Rebuild Active Directory from scratch. Exchange, you have to map all the mailboxes back. I mean, it's a complete nightmare.
Another topic that we considered adding to this thing was something called the Microsoft Operations Framework. How many people have heard of it? I'm actually curious about that. Oh, a lot of you have.
Wow.
Okay, very good, very good. We didn't want to bore you with the basics of MOF because this is an architect track, so we figured a lot of people already know that stuff. But really, that's really where you go to the patterns of, you know, is it ready for to be in the planning stage, delivery stage, and then sustainability stage. So there's a lot of planning with that, and we actually have what's called an ops wrap.
Yeah.
So that will actually go through and talk about operational agility and are you ready to deploy your software in a good way. So. Okay. And wrap means risk assessment program, by the way.
Right. So, wrap, risk assessment program. So there are some reactive considerations that I like to think of in terms of architecture also. We've got the disaster squared, the fight for root cause, and then how agile is your actual environment? How can we adapt to change? And there's actually some IT processes where you can look at it and say, this is really inefficient, and you can see where the bottlenecks exist in your org. So, but disaster squared, imagine if you're a hosting provider that does a search engine and Michael Jackson dies. How much more searching do you think is happening? How do you plan for that? How do you plan for being too successful for being able to handle the capacity for your load? Isn't that a job for the cloud to be able to dynamically expand? I think it is. I think it's the perfect argument for something like Azure for a backup. If you don't go in full feet into Azure, at least consider having an extension so that when, hey, you know what, the product my company makes, well, you know, it's the Furby for this year, it's the Tickle Me Elmo for this year. Everyone wants it. We're getting a billion hits a day on our web page. Be able to scale out your infrastructure into the cloud, have that sort of elasticity totally makes sense to me. And then do you have a disaster recovery plan? Does the plan actually work? Have you ever tried it? And I have a really good story. A really good story. So I get a call to go on site to a customer for a proactive engagement to talk about Windows 7 and how we're going to migrate from XP. So we're sitting there around the conference table, and they were a lot of sharp engineers, very good. I mean, they were asking really tough questions, and it was like, oh, yeah, they really get the technology. And one of the guys, all of a sudden, he gets a call, he picks up his phone. What do you mean? What are you talking about? And he starts cursing. The data center's on fire? Okay. So he hangs up the phone. Yeah, the data center's on fire. And I'm like, holy crap, their data center's on fire. So they look to the networking guy. The networking guy gets onto the switch and makes some routing changes and, you know, BGP and, you know, OSPF, blah, 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 does all these little changes in networking. And they say, okay, continue. I'm like, but your data center's on fire. It's okay, we have a data center engineer for that. Well, what about email? Well, it's all replicated in the SAN. We're fine. As soon as the fire alarms went off, they transferred everything over, cut it over with the network, and they were back up and running. And we continued talking about Windows 7 for the rest of the day. Who can do that? I can't even imagine how much time they spent on that disaster recovery plan.
And how calm they were.
Yeah. The data center is on fire. But that's okay. Let's talk about how we're going to upgrade deck from XP to 7 and migrate this particular app that we wrote in-house. Was that crazy? But that really happened. I'm like, I am in the TAM. Hey, their data center is on fire. We might need to have a crit sit or something. And he's like, what? And, well, okay, never mind. They want to keep talking about app compat.
Along those lines, too, is replicate your engineers. Replicate your operators. Replicate your people. Because inevitably, you're going to have that, thrown under the bus routine, right? Where the person who knows everything in your organization, who's the king of the world, and that person ends up going to the hospital because they got hit by a bus, or that hit by a bus routine. So had a customer who they had spent, probably months designing their SQL log shipping plans, going out to multiple areas, backups going out, being shipped out every day. I mean, they had disaster recovery going everywhere throughout the United States, and they're like feeling real good about this. And then I'm like, well, all of your engineers are here right in this office, right? Yeah. What if something bad happens here? Do you have a disaster recovery work? Because you guys won't be able to come into the office to work on this unless you can work from home. Or even then, if there's a really big disaster where their homes are now involved, it could be really bad. So, and that could take down an entire company. So also consider replicating your engineers to other locations.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about root cause. Root cause is great to have when you have an emergency and something breaks. Why? So we can learn from it, right? We want to be able to learn from our mistakes, change that. Like when an airplane crashes, they find out root cause, and that particular reason for the plane crashing doesn't happen again. They land, they ground the whole fleet, and they retool, and they fix everything. That's where we get root cause, and we actually deliver on it. What if you're a company that you installed Windows 2003 back in 2006 or 7, you're running Exchange on it, you never maintenance it, and finally you get a blue screen on the box in 2012? Do you need root cause? You do if you have a manager that thinks you do. But how do you accept the answer that the root cause is, well, you know, you're running a Broadcom driver from 2006, and it turns out that driver is really bad, and there's like 8 critical updates since 2006 that you're missing, and the firmware has a critical update for data corruption in the database, and by the way, you missed all the hot fixes that weren't security related because you don't apply those. That's very common. How many of you guys certify your images, right? Your builds for your servers, maybe even your workstations, you certify the build. What if Service Pack 1 is needed to fix a root cause problem, but you haven't certified it yet? That's actually pretty common to see in large enterprises where we become siloed and we become less agile. And what's the cost of us finding root cause? Would it have been cheaper for us to do a spring cleaning and update things every 6 months or a year in the data center? Does anyone have Rumbas in the data center? I think that would be totally awesome to have a couple of Rumbas running around dusting in the data center. No, I could never get my company to buy in on it. But really, are you looking at, are we doing the things we should be doing to maintain our system, or are we getting a crit sit, calling in and demanding root cause? When you have a heart attack, do you sit there and think, well, geez, you know, I wish I had root cause for this? Or do you think back and say, you know, if I hadn't been eating these steaks for the last 15 years, or maybe if I had exercised, or something. So it's that sort of mentality. If we're not maintaining things, the root cause is really our organizational structure. Could we have fixed that beforehand? Absolutely, we could have. Spring cleaning for servers is a great idea, I think. Particularly lately, the way firmware has been coming out. I have a laptop that has 34 firmware versions. You know, does anyone think the first one's really the good one?
It's a pattern.
It's a pattern. It's a complete pattern. So then how do we roll those out? How do we do spring cleaning when we have 100,000 hosts? That's a tough call. Do we upgrade BIOS on 10,000 workstations and 4,000 servers? Well, if you're virtualized, it's a little easier, isn't it? And then agility, our change control in our audit process. When something actually does break, can we act on it? How many times have you been on a crit sit where you go in and you're not allowed to touch the box because of audit?
Oh, yeah. Quite a few. As a matter of fact, I don't touch the box most of the time. I actually advise, help people out.
True. So. We advise, but there are times where you go in and it's, yeah, we can't do anything. You're just here for backup because of change control. Are we that structured that we can't be agile when we need to be?
And one of the customers I had, actually, they brought in all these consultants, about a team of consultants, and we thought it was great. It was like a little convention of our own little technology because we all were involved in the same stuff. And first hour of the analysis, we all found, oh, it's your disk drivers. You're using SCSI port drivers instead of store port drivers. It was a carryover from, they actually upgraded their Windows 2000 server to 2003 and carried over those old drivers with it. And now their disk I/O is extremely, extremely slow and bottlenecked right at that driver level. And we all, well, yeah, that's the problem. And we spent the rest of the week waiting on the change control because they couldn't change it fast enough. So keep that in mind. If you're going to bring in a bunch of consultants to help with things, that you may have to up and speed up your change control a little bit. So.
I did a Windows desktop risk assessment for a large enterprise, where we're going to analyze boot time. I was there for 5 days. 3.5 of them were sitting at a workstation waiting for someone to allow me to install .NET framework on a workstation.
Now, don't get me wrong, but there is reason to have change control. We're not saying don't get rid of change control. They are very important, and it needs to be regimented. So,
but it needs to be logical.
Yeah, it needs to be more logical.
Yeah. So. But really, the agility, are we Glacier? Are we a Glacier when it comes to the agility? Are we able to be nimble and make changes? There's been, Service Pack 1 for 2008 R2 has been out for a while. I have customers that still haven't certified it. So that's pretty difficult when you need to go forward with performance hot fixes, reliability hot fixes. Well, we haven't certified that. What's the value in certifying something? What's the value of staying on something that's certified that we know is broken? It's a tough message to get back to the business and to audit and to all the management, but you have to phrase it that way. What's the value of running on a build that's certified to run badly? Maybe we should go ahead and take a risk here.
How many people have read the book Zero Day by Mark Rozinovich?
Yeah.
A few of you? Yeah. So the ongoing theme of that book is that if you're not up to date on patches, proactively updating all your patches, that you could be that next company that's in the news of you have data corruption, or somebody took all your data and exposed all the privacy information. So, yeah. You know, keeping up on hot fixes and patches needs to be a normal operation in your business, and staying up and keeping going with that. I have some test consultant experience. I actually help a lot of customers with test consulting and testing. And we end up doing testing right means that you're going to spend more time testing the application or testing the image that you're working with more than it took to actually build the application in some cases. So testing is this big marshmallow at the end of the development cycle that just gets squished when you're behind schedule. But please, please, please consider doing testing more often and consider that part of your pattern.
There's some other things that we need to maybe think about in terms of large organizations. I taught a performance class once. This is one of my examples of why siloing is really bad. I taught a performance class in the middle of a blizzard a couple years ago. I mean, we were indoors, but it was still cold out. And I have one student. They flew me out to talk to one guy for 3 days. So I took him to lunch. What the hell? So we go to lunch. He's like, man, you know, I'd really like to find a new job. And it's like, well, go ahead. You just told me the unemployment rate's really low here. There must be a job somewhere. He's like, yeah, but I've been an administrator of IIS for the last 6.5 years. We're siloed. I was like, well, what do you do? Well, I make websites and I recycle worker pools. So is siloing good for staff where you're not allowed to touch things and grow and give feedback and actually go in and say, hey, you know, I think there's a better way of engineering? Well, no, he has no input whatsoever in how things are built. He recycles worker pools in a website. That's painful. Yeah, that's rough. That's the problem I see a lot in the org. Well, we only have one guy that administers that piece of software and he's on vacation, so you need to come back in a couple weeks. Well, I'm booked out 6 months in advance. I can't come back in 2 weeks.
Logistics.
Yeah.
It's tough.
It's rough. It's really rough.
Yeah.
The idea of shrinking staff is something that really can get to you. And then it kind of goes into that offshoring, outsourcing model also. What's the cost when we go from this to this in terms of flexibility, input? I mean, don't you think you would work better as a large team that actually does collaboration and builds things and everyone gets to, you know, say, hey, we think it should be done this way? Instead, we have that siloed approach. Less is more. Oh, you're on Facebook. That means we can cut down another head count, right? They'll have all those activities. So you run into that problem of, well, does anyone have an application in their environment where the guy that wrote it's dead? I have a customer like that. There's no source code. Runs in DOS. They won't replace it. Go to the business and say, this application you've used for the last 15 years and has never had any problems, you need to spend $8 million to rewrite it in 64-bit so it'll run on Windows Server 2008 R2. They laugh their head off every time that gets proposed, every year. Why? It works. It's written in DOS, but it works. But it's not documented either. No one knows how it works. Those magic widgets that we end up building because we don't do a repeatable build process, we don't document things, we don't build that knowledge library of how this thing actually functions and works, those are some of the risks that we see in the environment that are pretty common. The lack of, or the siloing ends up killing you in terms of being able to share knowledge. Yeah. So.
We only have a few more minutes left.
Oh, we do.
One of the key things we want to keep, one of our reoccurring themes here that we want you to take as a key takeaway is that in Premier Field Engineering, Microsoft Services, we actually have a lot of proactive services that actually helps alleviate a lot of this pain. So we're not just telling you, hey, just do this, do this, do this. We actually want to leave you that. We just want to give you a couple case studies that could have been preventable had we gone on site and done some proactive services to look at your environment and maybe tell you the elephant in the room so that everybody knows the elephant in the room at that point. So if you go to aka.ms, which is our shortcut thing, so aka.ms/proactive services, so aka.ms/proactive services, and that will actually take you to all of our proactive risk assessment programs, health checks, and workshops that will help you work with these issues and patterns.
I'm going to leave you with a joke. Right? I love that joke. I want to use this as an interview question, but the HR won't let me. All right, guys, thank you very much for your time. Have a good rest of the event. Thanks.
Thank you.